From meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. It's always a big treat to have Clint Van Zandt on the show. You'll know Clint as an MSNBC crime analyst, former FBI profiler, hostage negotiator, security expert, and someone who I like to go to talk about the big cases in the news. Hi, Clint.
Hey, Dana. Good evening.
Now, you do such good work on Newsvine.com, and of course, I picked up your most recent article, and we're going to get into Times Square here in a little bit, but I want to talk to you a little bit first about this Erica Blassberg sad story, LPGA golfer. Her death is certainly being questioned right now, and again, as you start, it says 25 years old. She had her whole life and career before her. So many stories like that. Let's talk about her.
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting story, too. You know, right after she died, and as you know, she was scheduled to play in a tournament, in an LPGA tournament last Monday. So in theory, she was supposed to leave Sunday and fly to Arkansas and play in that tournament. She allegedly had her airplane ticket. She had just been given a custom-made golf bag, and according to her family and friends, you know, was really looking forward to it. And then, as you know, shortly after noon on Sunday, someone found her in her bed. She was dead in her bed. You know, tabloid TV sometimes, Dana, just drives me crazy. Just after she was found dead, I was flipping through, you know, U.S. television, and I ran across one of the evening tabloid shows, and the host was suggesting her opinion that this young woman had obviously been murdered, that she'd probably been suffocated in her own bed. And, you know, you and I, as, you know, investigators, you say, where are you coming? Show me the physical evidence. Show me that her house had been broken into. Show me that, you know, there was evidence of a scuffle. I mean, this was an athletic woman who would have put up a fight. You know, show me that there was evidence that the blood vessels, you know, in her eyes or her face or something had burst based upon suffocation. That would have been obvious, if not to the first responder, at least to the ME. But, you know, none of that was there. And yet still these sensationalized programs tried to make something out of it. And, you know, as I looked at it, I thought, you know, this is going to be a very sad suicide. And what we've come to find out is that on Saturday night, she had sent a text message to her caddy, a female caddy, saying, "Don't get on the plane and go to Arkansas because I'm not going to play in that tournament." Well, to you and me, and I'm sure your listeners, that's, you know, short of being done under duress, which I don't think it was, that suggests that something was going on and that she had some obvious premonition that she wasn't, not only was not going to play in that tournament, but maybe something else. And when you start to look in her background, you know, you see she'd had some physical challenges, some injuries. She wasn't playing to what she thought her potential was. She maybe wasn't making the money she wanted. You know, her father was her coach, and I'm sure her father was very supportive, but, you know, he probably wanted more out of her, too. And you roll all of that together, and what it suggests is you started out your comments, you know, a very sad story, but you have to realize, you know, in the United States, 35,000 people commit suicide every year. Upwards of a million people make some type of attempted suicide. And as you and I know, men are far more successful because they usually use a weapon, a firearm. But women in the United States commit suicide at a rate three times that men do. And unfortunately, I think everything said and done, that's what this case is going to turn out to be. And of course, what the authorities are waiting for is to get, as they suggest, the toxicology results back. They want to see if there was any, you know, foreign substance, any you know, drugs, alcohol, anything else in her system that would have contributed to the, you know, the death of this very otherwise very successful, very positive, very upbeat 25-year-old woman who maybe, just maybe, committed suicide because her expectations of herself just were not met.
Clint Van Zandt is here. And, Clint, you make such a good point with the tabloid television broadcasts that jump the gun, so to speak, and try to make more of what the story really is. But the big picture here is the forensics, the evidence that will come back from that. And what I mean by forensics, the labs and everything else that may tell the real story. You do a lot of work in television, and it must be terribly frustrating for you and maybe some of the questions you get when you get interviews, even maybe from me, must be frustrating to you as an investigator and a former FBI agent to say, you're jumping the gun here a little bit. We got to sit back and wait a little bit before we get the real answer.
Well, I think that's always the positive thing about your show and the way you conduct your interviews is that, you know, as an investigator, that we can't go past the facts, we can't go past the physical evidence. I mean, can we start guessing? I mean, that's what television does. They guess at these things.
Yeah.
But if we stay with the evidence, if we stay with usually what is the simplest reason to explain what happened, and if there's physical evidence to support, to back that up, most of the time, you know, it's not going to be an episode of 24 from television. It's going to be something simple. It's going to be, we can, you know, most of the time, if someone is murdered, they're killed by somebody they know, somebody in their circle of friends, family. If it's a woman, it's been her current or former significant other. As long as we stay within that, you know, those known facts that investigators has. But, you know, as I say, when I saw this last week, and this host started with saying, "Oh, this couldn't have been a suicide. This was a murder. She was smothered." And that's when I turned television off. I thought, "This is ridiculous. All you're trying to do is fire up an audience, and then, you know, two or three days from now, you'll pretend you never said that." That's what I think is sad about television is that when they go to that length to try to keep an audience and to try to beat those drums to get people emotionally involved. I mean, it's sad enough when somebody died.
Yeah.
But let's take a deep breath. Is there any physical evidence to suggest this was? You and I know when somebody dies, it's going to be a homicide, it's going to be a suicide, it's going to be an accident, or it's going to be natural causes. You know, other than the great unknown, which sometimes we get back because there's just nothing else to show it, usually it's one of those four reasons. And with her demographics and her age group and things, you take a step back and you see what it looks like. But you and I know that's not what television is made out of. That's not dramatic enough to say this was sad. Let's make it a homicide. So anyway, I'll get off my soapbox on that one.
No, you're so right, though, Clinton. It's just so sad to see another young life, a young potential, all that potential there with this young girl. We see too much of it in the news.
A wonderful role model, Dana. You know, in her case, she dropped out of college in her sophomore year to turn professional, and you know, she had every potential there in the world. But you know, a lot of us never become what we want to do. But you know, so be it. That's what life is. Life is as much achievement as it is non-achievement. But you know, if we go out, we try, we do our best. If you succeed, fine. If you don't, if you know you did your best, that's what it's got to be. And it's, you know, when you get athletes or other people who are so competitive and so much, you know, you and I know, and so do your listeners, there's only one person who gets the gold, then there's a bronze, then there's a silver, then there's a bronze. Hey, there's a lot of people who participate in those type of events and never get a chance to go to the medal round, and they should feel good just about, you know, having done it. Hey, I've run a lot of 10K races in my life. I've never won one yet. In fact, I remember one. I saw a guy, he was running in front of me. There was a sign on his back, and it says, "If you can read this sign, you're in last place." It tells you what type of a runner I was.
Well, way to go. Clint Van Zandt's here, and we're talking some of the high-profile cases in the news today. And, of course, in this case, we have to sit back and let the professionals come up with a decision, a ruling on how this young girl lost her life. But I want to get into Times Square, Clint. Again, you and I have talked about for years now on the program about the public. Say what you see. and people paying attention, being vigilant since 9/11. And it doesn't matter what it is. In this case, an incompetent bomb maker, yes. The media actually in some cases feeling sorry for him, which drove me crazy. But again, a big story. Let's talk about it.
Well, you know, number one, I've seen, you know, the New York City Police Department and the FBI giving each other high fives and taking credit for having stopped this. They didn't, you know, the police didn't stop this guy. The FBI didn't stop this guy. In fact, he had been on the FBI's radar for a number of years. They knew about him. They knew at different times he was bringing money into the country. So he wasn't an unknown. But still, I mean, the only thing that stopped him, as you suggest, number one, he was an incompetent bomb maker. Fortunately, when he had traveled back overseas to attend bomb making classes, evidently when they were talking about how to hook up the detonator, he must have cut class that day. He wasn't there to do it.
Right.
But as most people know, this case was solved for two reasons. Number one, he was an incompetent bomb maker, and number two, citizens did what they're supposed to do. The T-shirt salesman on the street saw the car parked, saw the engine running, and did what you're supposed to do. Tell the police, who were able to come, intervene, deal with the car. But, Dana, if he had been a good bomb maker, just because the T-shirt salesman raised the alarm, all that probably would have done is have seen another police officer killed, as well as other people on the street had that device went off. But realize that, you know, bombs have been with us. Some people think car bombs are something new. You know, the first car bomb, and it really wasn't a car bomb, it was a horse and wagon bomb, was set off in the 1920s in the financial district of New York. It was a horse-drawn wagon with 100 pounds of dynamite and a couple of 100 pounds of lead weights that was detonated in the financial district that killed and wounded just dozens and dozens of people. So this is not a new phenomena, but it's something that's very hard to stop. And were we good on this one? We were lucky.
Yeah, you know, and that's so important. Luck is the key word here, I believe. And again, we certainly suggest to everyone out there, if you see something, tell something. Say what you see. But you and I talked about this, Clint, a few weeks back when we were talking about the anniversary of Oklahoma City and the Timothy McVeigh types that are out there. Now, this is long before 9/11, but now it's the focus has turned more to the war on terror. And again, how the media reports stories like this, going to bomb-making school in Pakistan, the late-night comedians grab a hold of it and make fun of it a little bit. But really, when it comes right down to it, the political beliefs aside, there's still that potential for another big 9/11-type situation in North America or anywhere because of these fundamentalists that are still running around out there, or am I wrong?
No, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, you look at how fortunate we've been recently. You know, you had Richard Reed, the shoe bomber.
Right.
Then you had the guy who was the underwear bomber over Detroit who wanted to bring that plane down in fiery pieces and bodies all over the top of Detroit. And now we have this guy here. I mean, any of these incidents, had they worked, we would have had another major, major situation. I mean, it just shows how close we are time after time again. And, you know, as all of us know, you know, to be a terrorist, you only have to be right once in a while, where the authorities, the investigators, and citizens on the alert, we've got to be right 100% of the time. So, unfortunately, it's just a matter of time where one of these guys, one more time, is going to get it right. And then we're going to be doing all this self-indictment. Oh, how could it happen? The CIA let us down. The Mounties let us down. Yep. The FBI let us down. You know, somebody let us down. Who did it? And, you know, the Republicans will blame the Democrats, and the Democrats will say, this all started under George W. Bush. And all this nonsense is going to go on. But I think it goes back to your original point, this level of radicalization that is taking place. You know, this happens on the internet. It happens in mosques and various places around the world. And until I was on Arab television last week, I think I mentioned to you when we were talking about your show here.
Yep.
And I was talking to one of the producers on this Arab television network. And when I went on, we were talking about this bombing, and they were trying to make the point, well, wasn't he, you know, didn't he do this because of the U.S. bombings that had taken place in Afghanistan and Pakistan and Iraq, and, you know, isn't the U.S. to blame? And I countered, I said, you know, until Muslims, Christians, whoever they are, until we learn to work together, until we learn to say that, you know, any loss of life is wrong, until we learn to say that terrorism is wrong, you can't blame it on the U.S. or Great Britain or anyone. You have to say, as citizens of the world, we all have this level of responsibility. And if we want to paint the U.S. as the bad guy and beat on them and say, well, 9/11 is justified because of, you know, U.S. involvement in the Middle East, that is trying to give justification to the taking of innocent lives. And just as, you know, the U.S., I'm sure there's no one in the military that is happy when we see innocent people die anywhere around the world, much less in a U.S. airstrike. It doesn't make it any better to kill innocent people in towers in 9/11 or to set off a truck bomb in downtown New York City when there are internationals from all over the world walking that street. They would have died for what? For how does, you know, an eye for an eye, how is that justified? And when I sat down with this producer and we talked for about 15 or 20 minutes, she said, you know, she said, if we could get more, she was speaking of her Muslim brother and sisterhood, she said, if we could get more to sit down and get past religion, get past politics, and talk on a one-to-one basis, she said, maybe we can resolve some of these issues.
Clint Van Zandt's here for about another 5 minutes, and we're talking about Times Square. I want to get your thoughts, Clint, on Arizona. When I introduced you, I said you're a former FBI profiler. And a lot of what we hear in the news today about Arizona and illegal immigration and law enforcement, they say it's nothing but profiling. When you have a law like they have in Arizona that if you're stopped in the street, you better be able to show where you come from. Let's clear that up a little bit. What really is the difference from what you did and still do as far as profiling to what some, you know, and I'm going to say it, some that don't really understand what Arizona is all about say when they say that law is nothing more than profiling?
Yeah, sure. A couple of things. You know, I think it's hard to, people are in your listening audience tonight, you know, whether we're conservative, whether we're liberal, there's a lot of us that say, rightfully so, if you pick out a person because of the color of his skin or his ability to speak English, if that's your criteria for stopping someone, if that's your sole criteria, that's wrong. But again, you know, if you haven't walked a mile in the shoes of the citizens of Arizona, if you're not seeing your tax dollars, tens of thousands of millions of dollars that are being spent in hospitals and schools and law enforcement because of the tremendous number of illegal aliens. You know, the bottom line in this country should be, if we don't want to have laws that deal with citizenship status, if we don't want to say it's illegal for someone to be in this country without proper documentation, then we ought to take the laws off the book.
Right.
But I think the people of Arizona are saying, hey, the rest of the United States, you don't understand the problem we have to deal with. And when we look at profiling, you know, if you look at a person, again, the color of their skin, if you look at, head covering they might wear, something like that, that is wrong. Any type of profiling that's done based upon race or creed or color. But, you know, if we talk profiling, what I think is important is behavioral profiling. And let me give you Boston Logan Airport for an example. A couple of years ago, shortly after 9/11, they initiated quote-unquote profiling at the airport, and they trained TSA people at the airport. They weren't looking for a person's skin color or age or anything else. They were looking for behavior. They were looking for eye movement. They were looking for certain questions. You know, it's the old, you've got a one-way ticket, you paid cash, and you don't have any bags with you. Well, that should be a clue. It's been a clue for years. And when someone comes through, they've got a one-way ticket, and you say, hey, where are you going? Well, I'm going to, who are you going to see there? You know, if they don't have a quick answer or anything, well, in the case of Boston's Logan Airport, in the first year after they initiated behavioral profiling, they made 100 arrests. Now, these weren't bomb-carrying terrorists, but these were people who were fugitives from justice, who were carrying drugs, who were carrying large amounts of cash, or who had other type of illegal substances or weapons, something like this. 100 arrests based upon behavioral profiling. And I think as long as we do that, and as you know, in Arizona, it's if they make a traffic stop, if they make a stop for any other reason, and the officer then, based upon that stop, has reason to question a person's citizenship. I think it's, you know, you ask me, can I see your driver's license? Sure. Here's my driver's license. That's proof that, you know, I'm in this country. I got a license. You know, and until we get to the point where everybody has to carry a passport, I think we have to balance it somewhat and realize, number one, this is not racial or ethnic profiling. And number two, you know, go down and live in Arizona and see what those people are dealing with and see how their tax base is eroding based upon the number of illegals that are coming across. You know, there's a lot of people that get in line to get into America, to get into Canada, other places. They do it the right way. If we're not going to ask everyone to do that, then we should just take the laws off the book, open the borders, and say every country in the world is wide open, come and go as you want.
You can see Clint on MSNBC, read his articles on Newsvine.com, and check out his webpage at livesecure.org. Always a pleasure, my friend. Thank you.
Thanks for having me. Good night.
Okay, buddy. Bye-bye. That's Clint Van Zandt, and all his years in the FBI make him someone I like to go to talk about these sorts of cases. We're going to take a break. We're going to be back in just a minute with former DA, someone who's very shy when she comes on the program about speaking her mind. No, I'm kidding. Wendy Murphy, to talk about Casey Anthony and some other things here on the Dana Pretzer Show. Okay, we're back. Wendy Murphy is here. You all know Wendy Murphy is a former DA, author, television analyst, law professor, and someone who I like to go to talk about cases in the news. Hi, Wendy.
Hey, Dana. Good to be with you again.
Yeah, it's nice to have you. I want to get a quick comment from you about the Casey Anthony death penalty hearing the other day. I had to admit I was thinking about you. I don't know why when I was watching it, because I would have loved to have seen the reaction on your face if you were sitting in that courtroom. And then we'll get into some other cases.
Yeah, well, you know, here's the thing. Although I didn't see it and, you know, what I've read about it, the idea that it's somehow unfair to have the death penalty on the table, or that there's something unseemly about that. I think, you know, whoever killed that child should face the death penalty. And I'm not even a fan of the death penalty, personally.
Yeah.
But if there is to be one, and the people have a right to make that decision, and it's certainly on the table in Florida, then if ever there's a case for the death penalty, it should be hurting and killing a defenseless child. You know, I'm not sure I understand, except that perhaps there's an argument somewhere that if a prosecutor puts it on the table just for strategic reasons and not because it's a legitimate option, you know, it's an interesting question. Should that be an option? Should a prosecutor be able to put it on the table just to put pressure on the defendant to plead, just to squeeze somebody to plead guilty? You know, defense attorneys do all kinds of tactical things that are outrageous for the purpose of gaining leverage. Is it fair for the prosecutor to do the same thing defense attorneys do? No, but can you understand why prosecutors sometimes do what they do in the face of a system where some of the most extraordinarily offensive tactics have produced the most unjust results? I'll just throw OJ out as an example. But, you know, when the public gets fed up with a system where only the bad guys get to do dirty tricks. And I'm not saying that this is necessarily how I feel about the issue. I think a prosecutor should absolutely, in good faith, whenever they believe they can prove that the death penalty is appropriate, should have it on the table. And they shouldn't pick and choose when it's on the table or not. It should be based on the evidence. And, you know, I'll just, again, say that I think it's pretty clear that whoever killed that child deserves the death penalty.
Yep.
I think it remains to be seen whether there's proof that Casey Anthony herself killed that child. I've said it on your show before, Dana. I'll say it again. There's a very good chance that somebody else killed Casey Anthony, Kaylee Anthony, and that Casey is responsible for burying the body and covering up what happened. And if the prosecutor is using the death penalty as a way of pressuring her to tell more about what she knows, in a way, I hope that's part of the story, because I'd really like more of the truth to come out. As far as we know right now, so little of the record is known.
Mm-hmm.
What we have heard from the beginning is what the defense wants us to hear, what the spin has been. As you know, the original case was filed and noted as a sex crimes case. What's that about? We all have a right to know.
Right.
So if part of the pressure from having the death penalty on the table leads to a fuller revelation of the truth about what happened, then I'm all for that. I think the public has a right to know, and I think, you know, when a child dies, we should all be demanding full disclosure of everything. If putting the death penalty on the table is part of getting to that truth, then I'm for it. But I think it's an interesting issue. I really do.
Yeah, and that's why I wanted to start with that tonight, because you and I have talked about this case many, many times, and there are many, many questions yet unanswered. But what I want to get to now is I'm reading an article that you sent out here. Females do abuse little girls. Discomfort is no excuse for injustice. Let's talk about Tanya Kraft.
Yeah, very quickly, and I'm so glad you're covering this case, because a lot of the coverage has been, I would say almost all of the coverage has been pro Tanya Kraft, and very little voice for the kids. For so many different reasons, the kids' perspective is not being told, including that Tanya Kraft spent $500,000 on her defense, which includes PR and lots of lawyers and people pounding the pavement and filling up the airwaves and the online airwaves, saying all kinds of things in her favor. And what bothers me is that she sort of started off in the case with a huge benefit, because she was a seemingly ordinary kindergarten teacher, married, mother of two little kids, accused of molesting three little girls ages 5 to 7. That just doesn't resonate with people. You know, so the benefit to her is that it doesn't fit with anyone's narrative about what a child molester looks like and what a child sex crime looks like. It's just not the picture that makes sense to us. And when you walk into a courtroom with that theatrical advantage, the prosecutor is already highly likely to lose, simply because the jury is going to sit in judgment and say, this makes no sense to me. And all the evidence that comes in is going to slip right by them, and it's not going to stick because it isn't salient. It doesn't fit with anything they know about how the world works. So what bothers me the most is that these three little kids, just talk about what these three little kids went through and how they described what happened, and the absurdity of thinking there was a conspiracy of 5-year-olds that somehow managed to trick all these experienced law enforcement officials into bringing false charges. It doesn't happen. It just doesn't happen. And I'm not saying that all kids always tell the truth all the time. They don't. Kids can lie, and they can even lie about abuse, but they can't lie well, because they're kids.
Right.
They're terrible liars, which is why they're great witnesses. And as an advocate for kids, I love to have kids as witnesses, because as long as we respect them and listen to them and hear them and vet them and judge them based on the fact that they're children and not impose adult standards on them, they are extremely credible witnesses. It's when we start to, say, well, the child was inconsistent, and adults wouldn't be inconsistent, so this child mustn't be telling the truth. You know, when kids are inconsistent, that's usually when they're particularly credible. It's the kid who's robotic and keeps saying the same thing over and over without context, without any what I call collateral benign details. You know, when the kid says, Johnny touched me. Oh, well, what room were you in? I don't know. Johnny touched me. Oh, was it daytime or nighttime? I don't know. Johnny touched me. That's the kid you worry about.
Yeah.
It's when little girls say, I was in the bathtub and she did this to me and she did that to me. And these kids were very explicit about how she touched them, the way the hand went, how it felt, the fact that she threatened to kill their families if they told. The kinds of things these kids described, the way they told, is so consistent with a credible child reporting a credible case of abuse, that to have no voice out there anywhere in the country saying these kids were credible. And yes, Tanya Kraft was acquitted. And let me be clear, she was acquitted. And that's fine. She deserves her freedom. But the fact that she was acquitted does not mean she's innocent, number one.
That's
and the
right.
fact that the jury found her guilty, in my opinion, wasn't because the evidence wasn't strong enough. The evidence was extremely strong. Not only three very credible kids who aren't sophisticated enough to lie over the course of time with credibility and all the salient collateral details to be a credible witness about sex abuse. By the way, these kids had no reason, no way of knowing about sexual abuse, much less to describe it as happening to their bodies. When you can't explain how a child comes to know such things and has this kind of adult knowledge, when you can't explain that, that's already a strong case. Plus, it wasn't one kid, it was three kids. One of them was her own child, and two of them had vaginal injuries, hymenal injuries.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't come from nowhere. So yes, it feels better to us to believe that a kindergarten teacher couldn't have, wouldn't have molested little girls, isn't interested in molesting little girls. It feels better to believe that myth because we all want to think when we send our children off to school that they're going to be safe when they get there. And that's fine. We all want to feel that sense of safety. But the reality is, Dana, even seemingly nice people who look really good on the outside are capable of dastardly things, and kindergarten teachers are among that class of people who could be dangerous. And if we can't open our eyes to that, then we collectively do a disservice to children. We are collectively responsible for abuse of children that goes without punishment if we can't open our minds to the possibility that she could be guilty, and to judge the evidence objectively with due respect for the fact that these children are children, not adults. And in my world, if I could redesign the legal system, one of the things I would do is provide an interpreter for kids. And just like we provide deaf people with interpreters, I provide a child interpreter in every case so as to make sure that the questions are fair, the children understand the question, that their answers are understood in context, and that the jury doesn't go into the jury room and say, well, you know, that kid didn't remember something, and so she must be telling a lie. You know, it's just so rotten the way we don't respect kids and how they think and how they process information. This was a very strong case. It's unfortunate it landed in acquittal, but the more unfortunate thing is the collective public consciousness will never reach the truth because so much money was spent on Tanya Kraft's defense. She was in all the shows without anybody speaking up for the kids.
Yeah.
So I worry that in the future, juries in other cases are going to say, oh, this must be like the Tanya Kraft case. That's not fair to children as a class in this country, and they're citizens too. They deserve more respect.
You know, we would all be very naive if we don't say that juries are influenced by the media, and this is such a big case, Wendy. And I guess my next question to you is about the jury screening process itself in a case like this or other cases in the future. Do we need to relook at that?
Yeah, and it's one of the things I write about in my book in terms of systemic reform. One thing we absolutely should be doing better is starting off these cases by saying, who are these jurors?
Yep.
Are they capable of appreciating and understanding that this person could be guilty, or are they going to walk into this case predisposed to reject everything because of their biases, their prejudices against children, against certain types of people? For example, Tanya Kraft was a seemingly heterosexual woman married with two little kids, and, you know, a jury, because of some strange bias about heterosexual people, heterosexual women, might say to themselves, well, you know, she doesn't like females, so she's not going to be sexually interested in little girls. As it turns out, Tanya Kraft had lesbian interests. That doesn't make her a child molester, and I have to be clear about that.
Yeah.
Just because she had interest in women in a sexual way doesn't mean she has any interest in children, much less female children. But the data says that if you are both a gay person and a molester, you're more likely to select your own sex. I don't even care that, you know, about that data per se in this case, but what's important is if the jury was going to conclude that she couldn't possibly be guilty because she was a heterosexual married mother of two little children, then the system should have screened out those jurors. The jurors should have been disallowed to sit if they came predisposed to believe that who she seemed to be meant she couldn't possibly have done it. We also need to instruct jurors better. So it's the selection process. It's the instruction process. They should be commanded. When you go and decide this case, you have a job to do. You have to stop with your biases at the door, get in there with an open mind. You may not conclude that just because she's heterosexual, she couldn't be guilty. Just because she's gay, she must be guilty. Those kinds of prejudices have no place in our courtrooms. Bigotry is not part of what a healthy democracy looks like when we're doing justice. But we don't do that. We actually indulge prejudice. We don't stop it. And that's part of, again, part of why I think she prevailed in this case. And, you know, my concern is that we do such a disservice to kids, not only for those reasons, but remember the Michael Jackson trial, the jurors were screened, but they were screened in the strangest way. If you felt prejudice against Michael Jackson because of his race, you were kicked off. That's fine. But if you felt prejudice against Michael Jackson because he was wealthy and a celebrity, you got kicked off. That makes no sense to me. That's not the kind of bias we should care about. If anything, if people think a rich person gets a better form of justice, they should be allowed to sit in judgment, because that's probably a correct prejudice that needs to be there, that kind of, you know, critical eye. And then if you, the jury was asked, do you or anyone close to you have any history of being sexually abused as a child? So if you knew someone, or if you had been sexually abused as a child, you got kicked off the jury. But the jury was never asked, have you or anyone close to you ever committed an act of sexual abuse? In other words, if you were a molester and you just never got caught, which, by the way, is 90% of molesters in this country, you could sit in judgment on the Michael Jackson case and just think to yourself, well, I'm like him, and I don't want to get caught, so I think I'll vote not guilty just so I don't get caught and, you know, protect my molester buddies. It's a problem. Yeah. We have a huge problem in this country in that we let jurors sit in judgment of children, even though they're chock full of the most hateful ideas about children, and boy, have we got a long way to go on that.
Wendy Murphy's here for the next couple of minutes, and you talked about being open-minded. The media needs to be more open-minded too, Wendy, and I'll let you finish with that when it comes to reporting these sorts of cases.
Yeah, I mean, one of the bad things about the media in the Tanya Kraft case in particular was the extent to which, and Larry King did this, he'd have on a person to say, well, Tanya, you know, boy, she's innocent, and here's why, and then her family would be on, and then her friend would be on, and then, you know, they'd have some lawyer on saying, yeah, isn't it terrible that the children aren't telling the truth, and poor Tanya. No responsible media can talk truthfully about this kind of case and have four people on, all of whom say the same thing. That's just unbelievable to me, and Larry King should know better. You know, he always talks about being fair and so forth. He was profoundly unfair on this story. On the NBC Today show, although they did a lot that was supportive of Tanya Kraft, I got to give them credit. At least they had me on one day with Matt Lauer to give the kid side of the story and to help to, you know, promote the reality of the way children tell and how they experience things and what could be true. So I give them credit. But by and large, I think the media does not do its due diligence in these cases. They indulge the powerful. The powerful are the adults. The powerful are the adults with $500,000 to spend on PR, which then produces only a certain kind of spin. Kids don't vote. They don't have any money. And if the media can't find it in their ethical responsibility to promote the children's voice, even if the kids aren't pounding the pavement to make them do it, if they can't find a way to give voice to the kids' position, then shame on them. Shame on them. And that was a big problem in this case. And I wish I knew what the answer to that was. I mean, frankly, I'd like to give kids the vote or a bundle of dough, but, you know, don't hold your breath for either of those things. In the meantime, we have to have adults, responsible adults, force-feeding the media, you know, not only the story that needs to be told, but criticism in the aftermath of not telling the story. And I hope parents are out there, hope some of your audience listening to this will take the time to write nasty letters to all the media and say, what is your problem that you couldn't even responsibly tell the children's side of the story? Shame on you. We need to do that as a public. We need to do that on behalf of kids because, boy, you know, there's no more powerless kid, no more powerless citizen in the country.
Absolutely. Her book is And Justice for Some. You know, Wendy is a former DA, television commentator, author, and all-around favorite guest here. Thanks, Wendy.
Thanks, too, Dana. Bye-bye.
And, you know, she says it like it is, and that's the important thing. We're going to be back with someone else who says it like it is, Robin Sachs, also a former DA, someone who's out looking for that kook, John Mark Carr. I wonder how many times John Mark Carr has been on the website checking us out tonight. We'll find out with Robin Sachs here in a minute when we come back to Scared Monkeys Radio and me, Dana Pretzer, on The Dana Pretzer Show. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. This is our weekly Nothing But the Sacks segment with former DA, felony DA Robin Sachs, NBC news analyst, author, all-around great gal. Hi, Robin.
Hey, how are you?
I did my Homer Simpson scream tonight when I went to listen to Justice Interrupted, and I go to the world-famous Justice Interrupted webpage to see that you are on hiatus. You and Super Cop there are just too darn busy, are you?
God, I know. I'm wishing you're not highlighting it because it's really frustrating to both of us, but we are so busy right now that we just don't have the time to properly get our show together this week.
No, I think it's important to get that out. So justiceinterrupted.com is the website. Make sure and check it out to find out when the radio show will come back and to learn more about what's going on with Justice Interrupted. Now, last time I had you on the show, there was a fine group of guests, and we were all talking about that Looney Tune John Mark Carr, and I want to get an update from you what's going on with John Mark Carr or Alexis or whatever he's calling or she's calling himself or herself this week.
There's a lot that's been actually going on in that case. I have a court date tomorrow. I am going to San Francisco and will be appearing in front of a judge in Department 218 at the McAllister Court, where he will have to determine whether or not my restraining order will remain in effect despite the fact that we have not served him. I'm going to show a lot of due diligence tomorrow. I can't reveal what that due diligence is right now on your radio waves because I wouldn't want to let all my secrets out yet, but I suspect the restraining order will stay in effect. As the story progresses, there's a lot of new stuff that's gone on. We believe we've identified where he is in pretty close proximity, and now we'll see if it works.
Well, you know, he or she may even be listening to the program tonight, and again, the offer is always open to feel free to contact me, and we can talk about where he or she is. Let's get into the story a little bit. If people are listening either live or on the podcast in the next few days saying, John Mark Carr, what's this all about?
Well, John Mark Carr, you know, it's kind of interesting. Everyone kind of has written John Mark Carr off. People remember even his name, even serious crime followers remember, you know, certainly remember the name, but seem to only remember him as the one who is the Looney Tunes who falsely confessed to the killing of JonBenet Ramsey.
Right.
If you were to check out his blogs, although there's, you know, beliefs or people suggest that he, you know, maintains them himself, he does probably, at least the blog I'm talking about. But he still is self-proclaiming that he is the killer. He hasn't bowed down from that. And I think that's one thing that people would find surprising is that in terms of the JonBenet stuff, is he still takes credit for killing JonBenet Ramsey. But I am very separately not interested. That's not my concern right now. I represent Samantha Spiegel, who is a 19-year-old girl who got in conversations with John Mark Carr after reuniting with him. He was her teacher when she was 9 years old. And in very short order, a conversation of, that seemed pretty innocuous turned into soliciting her to help find little girls for him. And the pedophilia and the amount of people out there working on his behalf is real and dangerous.
Yeah, no, for sure. And if you go to robinsacks.com, you'll see a little wanted poster icon of John Mark Carr. Click on it, and it'll take you to a webpage that has some interesting insights about this individual, dangerous to say the least, correct?
That's right. And that website is Alexis Loran, Valoran, like R-E-I-C-H, and it goes back through all the recent history of the case and the older history dealing back in the JonBenet times, and there are definite threats. I know people think that this is someone who just, you know, is kind of one of those loons who rant and rave, but he is very real. She's very real.
Yeah.
And the thing that, is crazy is the amount of people who seem to protect him, but also the amount of people who he thinks protect him who really are people he cannot trust, people who've written him off, family members of his and so forth, are becoming the keys to our success.
He is an individual, and again, whether you consider him to be an attention grabber or whatever, he's made some serious threats here and has bragged about doing some illegal things, and his fixation with children is something that this goof needs to get off the street. Again, if you want to hear the interview that we did with this last week, go to their webpage at Scared Monkeys Radio, or the webpage that Robin just mentioned. There's a link to that interview there, too. Robin Sachs is here. And I want to get your thoughts on Roman Polanski. You and I have talked about Roman Polanski many, many times. And now it looks like there's a new victim that has come forward.
Yeah, well, I want to go there. One thing I want to say just on the John Mark Carr front, if to people, just to get a sense of his real kind of craziness, something that I didn't even recall that happened a few years back when he was in the car with Barbara Walters and some producers for ABC, and while on the road to have an interview, he wanted to stop at a school where he taught at to look at little girls with producers from ABC in the car. So this is someone, I mean, it's crazy. So anyway, I digress into that story. But Roman Polanski, I believe that this new victim emerging, for whatever people think of her, disclosing now, having Gloria Allred or what have you, I believe will change the landscape of this case incredibly.
Well, in fact, my commentary tomorrow deals with the Cannes Film Festival and how there's a petition going around, although it wouldn't be worth much, but it'd be certainly fodder for the media to grab a hold of, with all the directors and the yuppies that are running around there that think that Roman Polanski should go free. We can't forget Whoopi Goldberg's comment that, well, it wasn't really rape. Let's talk about that thinking, the Hollywood thinking about a character like Roman Polanski, who seriously has issues when it comes to young girls.
Yeah, I mean, that was, I mean, one thing that this disclosure does is put perspective that, you know, one-time isolated incident philosophy, and now starting to look at someone as being actually serial, dangerous, and a threat to, you know, this wasn't just an isolated incident blown out of proportion. But the thing that it also does is that now it kind of puts on the table, how far, Roman Polanski, do you want to take this? You know, it's a little bit of the be careful what you wish for. Mm-hmm. You know, the more that this goes, it's kind of the worse it gets for him. And, you know, yes, he may have escaped and he had all of these years of freedom. But, you know, in the end, is this going to be someone who's going to spend the last years of their lives in prison and make this their ultimate fight of their life? Because now, if he, depending on how he undoes this, there are laws in the state of California that not only allows for potentially the prosecution of this case, should that be the route the prosecutors choose, but certainly to use it as corroborative evidence. So if you undo the whole plea, which you can only do if he actually gets to California, it could really start shaking things up in terms of how far do you want to see this get undone?
Robin Sachs is here. Robin Sachs, NBC News analyst. What's going on with that now?
You know, I had a very weird moment. I shared these moments with you before, but this last Friday was the sentencing of John Gardner, and right. That was a case in which on one side of the courtroom at the time of the sentencing sat the King family, the Amber DeBlas family, and the many volunteers and support for those family that had been along kind of the whole way, the people who were actually invited. There was only invited people in the courtroom because it filled to capacity. And then there was 26 seats saved for the media. And because I work with the DeBlas family and representing them as their lawyer, I was kind of with the friends and family side as opposed to being on the media side. And I have to tell you, the feeling of loss and pain and suffering that was in that courtroom was unbelievable on Friday. I have never felt so glum in my life, frankly. I mean, of all the cases I had, just listening to all those parents and listening to Candace McConnell talk about her experience and talk about the utter horror one's life turns into following the abduction, murder, and rape of a daughter, a young girl. It was really one of the most difficult court appearances I've ever sat through. And I was kind of happy I didn't have to have the media face on so that I could kind of spend the rest of the afternoon processing it myself, frankly.
Well, it's something that you do good work with. And, you know, Robin, I wish you luck tomorrow in San Francisco. And, again, any information to find John Mark Carr from the listeners would certainly be appreciated. Thanks again. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you so much, Janet. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That's Robin Sachs, former DA, author, attorney, and on the hunt for John Mark Carr. That's John Mark Carr. Remember the guy who claimed to have killed JonBenet Ramsey? Well, he has some other problems now, and including the fact that he may be a she. It's hard to say. Anyway, another favorite guest of the program is criminal profiler Pat Brown. I sat down with Pat Brown earlier today to talk about her new book called, fittingly, The Profiler. Okay, welcome back. One of our most favorite guests, is that proper English? I'm not sure, is Pat Brown. She is a criminal profiler. You see her on Nancy Grace's show and other programs, and she's a good friend of the program. Hi, Pat.
Hey, how you doing, Dana?
I'm good. The Profiler, My Life Hunting Serial Killers and Psychopaths. Sounds like some people's marriages. No, I shouldn't say that. is coming out Tuesday.
Something about that, yes. Actually, it is about that, because some people have married those people. So
exactly.
We'll find those in the book.
Coming out Tuesday the 18th, currently available for pre-order at Amazon.com. Congratulations. I know we have talked about it briefly in the past, but now it is for real. Tell us about The Profiler.
Oh, yes. It's finally coming out. I mean, it's one of those things that's a long year from the time that you you know, plan to write the thing until it gets to the market, and it is coming out on Tuesday, and I'm very excited about it because it's a different kind of book, and I think a lot of people will find, well, they're going to find three different kinds of things about the book. One is that I hope it's inspirational mm-hmm. to many citizens that they can go out and try to do something about an issue they find in society. That they'll realize you can do something about it, no matter who you are, because I was over 40 when I started into this life of criminal profiling. I had to start out with self-training, then I had to go into seminar taking, and finally got a master's degree. I did all kinds of different things to get ahead so I could make a difference. And I want to encourage people that doesn't matter who you are, where you're from, or how old you are, whether you're male or female, you see a need. It's not an easy road. I'd like to tell them that.
Yeah.
Not an easy road, but you can keep going on it, and you will eventually start seeing progress if you just keep your mind, set on a goal. So that's one thing I want people to get from the book. And the second one is that some of the criminal justice stuff that goes on with cases, with homicide cases, is not what people think it is. Most of us think that cases are solved very quickly. We think that most cases are solved, and really that is not true. The easy cases are solved.
Right.
But the more difficult cases, stranger homicides, for example, most of those go unsolved. We have a problem in the system. We need to change our methodology, and especially we need to get those profilers, and that could be detectives themselves, working, doing crime analysis in the very early parts of the case. And that's something, that's a part I know I really want to get through to people. That's just really, really important to me.
You know, one thing.
The third one. Now I'm blanking on what it was.
Okay.
So, what was my third point here?
Well, maybe it'll come back to you.
I'll get to it.
It'll come back to you. Listen, you always told me you were only 41, so that's a lot of work to do in just 1 year.
Oh, I'm 41. Yeah. I wish. I just celebrated my mother's 90th birthday with her today, so. I don't think she had me that old.
No.
that would be a tricky one.
Well, listen, happy birthday to Mom. Pat Brown's here talking about her new book, The Profiler, My Life Hunting Serial Killers and Psychopaths. You know, you mentioned a good point about how quickly or how the public perceives crimes are solved, and I happen to be watching one of our cable news crime shows, or so-called cable news crime show, in my opinion, the other day. And one of the talking heads on the show said, well, everyone knows that most homicides are solved within 20 minutes of the time that they're called in. And I had to, I heard the Twilight Zone music playing, and I had to slap myself a couple of times and thought,
well,
wow.
What they might be talking about is, generally speaking, most homicides are committed by people who know each other.
Yeah.
In the heat of a moment. So, yeah, when you see a guy pull out a gun and shoot his buddy in front of about eight people, that one you can solve pretty quickly.
Sure.
But you can't. But the ones that are more difficult, where they're done behind closed doors, or the person's just, the body is just found someplace, those can be extremely, extremely difficult. And we really need to do some changing in that. The third point I was going to make, I knew there was a third point here. Some people reading this book get a little upset because I take issue with some of the FBI profiling. Many people have read the FBI books, Robert Ressler, John Douglas. They're fabulous books. They're very fascinating, especially when they go into the history of the different serial killers and some of the famous ones that we all like to read about, like Ted Bundy and, the big guys, Green River Killer. That's very fascinating. And it's fascinating to see how the whole big FBI machine kind of runs, how you get the task force out and you do all these things. But my issue, and which I bring up in the book, is, these are great stories, and I'm not saying that some of these FBI profilers haven't done some good work. But my belief is that the inductive method of profiling that they have used and have promoted is not particularly effective. Mm-hmm. And people say, how dare can you say that, because one of the things you'll find in this book is that I take people through many cases, and it'll be fascinating for them to understand how these cases are profiled and get into the minds of the people there and see how I'm, trying to figure this stuff out. And I'm hoping that they'll read this and realize, wow, that's a good profile. Why isn't it getting prosecuted? And where's your track record? You're profiling these cases, but, hey, they're not getting prosecuted. Ah, that's correct, because I'm being brought in 5 to 10 years too late. The evidence is gone.
Right.
You can't point to the right guy then, and then, there's no evidence to back it 5 years later. But if you look at the FBI record, take a look at Green River Killer. He was out there for 40 years. The FBI worked that case. Ted Bundy killed, I don't know how many women, at least 24 women before he got caught.
Right.
BTK, 31 years.
Yeah.
FBI worked that case, too. Whoa, where's the track record, folks? So that's the whole point. I don't believe inductive profiling has been particularly useful. I know that guy has had an opportunity to be there even sooner with more abilities to get work with law enforcement, and yet it's not helping. So what we need is to get deductive profiling. That's my style of profiling, which says you get right down there nitty-gritty working with the crime scene information, the forensics, the behavioral stuff. You get right down there. But you have to get in on the ground floor 24 to 48 hours into the crime. So we need dedicated detectives in each department to be profilers of their own. Or we need to bring in have a big police department. You have a criminal profiler working on the premises. So when you get a new case, the detective gets that case in, he goes and he starts gathering information. But meanwhile, while he's doing all that work, the profiler is sitting there analyzing the crime scene. So when the detective walks back in, he goes, what you got for me?
Mm-hmm.
That guy can say, hey, I've been studying this for the last 48 hours. Here's what I've got. Here's what I see happen to the crime scene. Here's what I see the motive is. Here's what I see the investigative leads. He's there in the beginning. That's deductive profiling. That's what we need in every department across the country. If we want to see a change in the closure rates, instead of waiting 30 years to catch a serial killer, it's just too long.
Yeah, for sure. No, and you make such a good point, Pat. Pat Brown's here talking about her new book, which will be coming out May 18th. You can pre-order now at Amazon, called The Profiler, My Life Hunting Serial Killers and Psychopaths. It's the public perception, and where does the public get their perception from? But the media, and you do a lot of media work.
And
when you hear FBI, they think, oh, good, the FBI is involved, so everything will be fine. And I think you address that.
Correct. And, it's not that I don't appreciate, a lot of the hard work out there that they have done.
Sure.
They've, especially for the research they've done over the years to help us understand serial killers and how they operate and what their methods are. That's all been great. But in the long run, I just haven't seen that the inductive profiling method to be particularly effective. So rather than sit there and say, well, they're such great guys, we shouldn't even touch this, my thing is to say, let's look to see if something's working.
Mm-hmm.
If it's not working, why isn't it working, and what do we do? What do we need to do to fix it? And that can be, same thing with myself or deductive profilers or detectives. We have to look and say, if we're not closing cases, what's our problem? It might be that we don't have enough manpower. It might be that we don't have enough training. And I think training is a big, huge issue in this country. Most detectives don't get much training.
No.
People don't realize that, but
you know, a lot of detectives come off the street. They've been, you know, a street cop, a patrol cop for like 3 years.
Yep.
And they get booted up to a robbery or, you know, homicide eventually. And they don't necessarily get that much training because the department doesn't have any money.
Yeah.
So they might go off for a week's training in a year.
Yeah.
And then they go work on cases and hopefully they learn on the job. But they need the training. And that's one of the things my organization, the Sexual Homicide Exchange, is working to do, is bring training to the police departments so that they can become adept at profiling themselves. Because here's something kind of funny about it. We're talking about the FBI and the profiling, kind of the profiling gods, you know. We have Robert Ressler, John Douglas, you know, they've been out there for so long. We, you know, everybody's very enamored by them. And if you're not them, they think you can't profile.
Right.
But here's my point. How many cases do we have across the United States that need profiling? Thousands. I'm sorry, but I don't think Robert Ressler, John Douglas, or I can do 1,000 cases at the same time.
No.
we're just not that, you know, we're not that good, and we're not that, you know, we can't expand that much energy at the same time. So we need to have hundreds of profilers across the United States. So we need to think of ourselves not as gods of profiling. We're the only ones who can profile. We need to think that we have a skill that can be transferred to somebody else. If we teach other people, they should be able to do it. Just like we don't have only 3 doctors in the United States or only 3 lawyers, God sakes, how are we going to get anything done?
Yeah.
So we can't have 3 or 4 profilers in the entire United States. I want to see profilers all over the United States.
Yep.
In every police department. So I believe I'm a good profiler, but I think other people can be good profilers too, and we just need to get the training out there so they can learn to do it.
Absolutely. Education is so important, and a 3-day seminar with Pat Brown might be interesting. You may learn something, but it does not make you an expert. That's for sure.
That won't be enough, no. It'll be a lot longer than that.
Listen, I'm going to give you the last word, and I always ask my authors when they have a new book out. I'm looking at the cover of it right now, and that alone is enough for me to pick it up and to take it home. But what would, of course, I know you, but what would you want the reader to be able to walk away with after they've read your book?
Well, I hope they're inspired to do things in their, you know, realize they can do things in life. I hope they realize they need to support, you know, increasing our training and our funding and our manpower in the criminal justice system. We need to change what's going on. And I hope they just enjoy it, because this is the first time, I think, it is the first time, I'll say that, the first time a profiling book has ever really taken the readers behind the scenes. I have a lot of cases in the book, but I don't do it. It's not really technically done, where say, and then the force task force went in, and then we set up operations. It's not like that. It's like you and I, the reader and I, are going to go look at this case. We're going to get in the car and drive to a trailer home, and we're going to knock on the door and say, "Hey, Joe, we're here to work on this case." So I'm taking them right behind the scenes, as I went behind the scenes when I went worked with the police department, talked to the families, did interviews with suspects, just right there, hands-on. They will feel like they're with me. They will feel like they're actually almost in a television show, going through these different cases and experiencing the people and the mindset of these the folks, some of these serial killers and psychopaths and other creepy people. They'll feel the victims, what the victims are going through. It's just very down-to-earth, and it'll unfold like a television show for them. So it's not. I want them to go away with thinking, we want to change the system, and I want them to go away inspired to help do something in this world. But they're going to also just have a lot of fun learning how to profile and finding out how it's done. And I think they're just going to find it hands-on fun. So it's an enjoyable read, along with the stuff I'm, you know, the message I'm trying to get through with it. It's an enjoyable, fun read.
Sounds great. Again, the book is The Profiler. Go to Amazon. It comes out May 18th. Thank you, Pat.
Okay, well, thanks, Dana.
Happy 41st birthday, by the way.
Yeah, I wish.
Okay, all right.
I'll keep remembering that one. Keep ticking backwards.
Talk to you again soon.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
That's Pat Brown, and of course you can catch her on shows like Nancy Grace and others, and she works well as a criminal profiler. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back. And we are right back, and I hope you enjoyed tonight's show. Remember, our webpage is www.scaredmonkeysradio.com. There you can listen to the show live, pick up podcasts of past shows, daily commentaries, leave comments, whatever. I hope you enjoyed it. We'll see you again real soon here on the Dana Pretzer Show. Good night.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guests' websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.